Good evening and welcome to this meeting of the Tea Party. Now, this year's goal is very important. We have to defeat President Obama. Now, we conservatives have been working for the last year to find an inspirational and exciting leader to do just that. And since we couldn't find one, we nominated Mitt Romney. So now, we're going to have to do what we've got to do. Well, since we've had Barack, we've been outraged, and now we've got Mitt. We want the Senate back, so we tried to get Todd Akin to quit.
Oh, Romney, it took some time, but we're starting to get in line.
You gotta help me, Romney, help us show Obama the door.
Bow, 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 bow. Help me, Romney, help me, Romney.
Tell him start packing. Ooh.
Eric Holder, give the cold shoulder.
Tell Panetta we're gonna get ya.
Adios, please, to Miss Pelosi.
Send Tim Geithner over to frighten her.
Help me, Romney, yeah.
We can't take any more.
I'll tell you what, if this Obamacare goes into effect, I might just leave the country.
Yeah, enough of this socialized health care. I'm moving to Canada.
Hey, that if everyone has to have health insurance, yeah, my business is going to suffer.
He's a mortician.
Bow, 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 bow. Help us, Romney, help me to call me.
As a mean trick, let's all get real sick.
Hey, guess what they're accusing Paul Ryan of now? They're accusing him of supporting death panels.
What? He would never do that to anyone.
Oh, no, 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 not death panels for people.
Send death panels where?
To kill Obamacare.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. You can now hear Great Speeches and Interviews at 96.5 FM in the Sacramento area. Today's program is a call to action. President Jimmy Carter talks about human rights abuses against women around the world and discusses what can be done about the problem.
I was very happy when John Kerry adopted that goal of his own to try to negotiate between the two. And I communicate with him on occasion. I met with him personally. I won't go into detail because it's one of those things that I don't want to get involved with as a criticism of the president. But one of the last things I said was that I hope that when John Kerry comes out with his so-called roadmap, that it will not deviate from longstanding international law. It was approved by Israel in 1967 and by the United States, and this permeates the entire European community on a unanimous basis. And all the Arab countries have adopted it, and that is basically that the 1967 borders would prevail, that there be two states, Israel and Palestine, living next to each other, and that there can be some minor modifications of the border to accommodate the settlements close to Jerusalem, and then the Palestinians have their own state. Well, this is something that I hope can be done, and my hope is that the United States will be very forceful in putting forward an accurate and fair so-called roadmap, and that the president will put the full force of the United States government and his own personal force behind the roadmap when it's promulgated. The Palestinians have declared publicly, I meet with them regularly, that they don't insist on any sort of military or military capability. They're perfectly willing for the entire Palestinian state, that is the West Bank and Gaza, to be completely covered with peace forces from the United Nations or from the United States and so forth. But that's what has to be done. And I think that the so-called right of return has to be modified. I can't imagine that it would be advantageous for anybody if a large number of Palestinians move back into Israel itself. They might be compensated in some way, in a reasonable fashion, but I think that we should let the Palestinians that want to return to the West Bank and Gaza do so, to the new Palestinian thing. So it's too complicated to answer in a brief period of time, but I think that's what should be done.
I hear you saying that unless President Obama himself gets more involved, this will
fail. Well, he doesn't have to be involved in the negotiation, but he has to make sure that once John Kerry comes forward with what I'm sure will be a roadmap approved by President Obama, that he lets the whole world know this is the United States position and we will insist on its being honored.
And before we leave this area, I want to ask, I think if an Israeli were sitting in our audience today, that person might reasonably ask, why does President Carter use words like apartheid that are going to offend and upset us? And Israelis would say are not accurate. And we may have a lot of problems, but we're not South Africa under that government, and we're not going to be. So how would you answer that? Somebody said, this is deliberately provocative and hurtful to us. Why does President Carter do that?
David, you're probably the 5,000th person that's asked me that, including Israelis when I go there and Jewish Americans, and I point out the name of my book, Palestine Peace, Not Apartheid. And my point was, and still is, we need to have peace so that we will not have apartheid. And I've never said in any of my detailed writings or any of my public statements that Israel is perpetrating apartheid on the Palestinians. But I think if we don't have a two-state solution, and if the Palestinians are not given equal rights, if we have a one-state solution, then you would have apartheid there because the Jews who command the one nation, which I don't want to see, would have to relegate the Palestinians to a secondary position legally in a joint nation. So a two-state solution with Palestinians living here and Israelis living there in peace is what I've advocated. But I have never in my life insinuated that apartheid exists in Israel.
Thanks.
Given the fact that we're talking about controversy.
I've heard about it. Go ahead.
Well, you left the Southern Baptist Convention.
Yes.
Because they would not allow women pastors. They wouldn't, as you pointed out earlier, they wouldn't allow women to teach if men were there. Women had to be submissive to their husbands. I want to know a little bit about your evolution, because you went to the Naval Academy, you married a beautiful young woman, you had a very traditional marriage. I mean, you became governor, she didn't, you became president, she didn't, she was the wife and the helpmeet, mm-hmm. mother, all of that. At what point did you sort of wake up one morning and say, oh, my wife may be as smarter than I am. women actually are equal. And what drove you to, was there a moment when you realized that? I mean, what drove you to leave the Southern Baptist? Because that had to have been very difficult for you and very painful for you to go against your own church and your own people.
Well, let me say quickly that Rose and I went to the same high school. We were born in the same town. When she was born, I lived next door to her. I was 3 years old when she was born. And she was valedictorian of a high school class at Plains High School. I was not valedictorian. So I knew from the very beginning she was smarter than I was. But I was a very active member of the Southern Baptist Convention. My father was a deacon before me in the same church. I was baptized in the Plains Baptist Church. I began to teach Sunday school classes when I was a midshipman at the Naval Academy when I was 18 years old. I'm 89 years old, so I've been teaching Sunday school classes for 71 years now. I've been through the Bible I don't know how many times and taught. And now we have a very small church in Plains, and we have women deacons and women pastors in our church. My wife is a deacon, by the way. So I came to the realization that I needed to change from the Southern Baptist Convention to a more moderate Baptist church without any real anguish on my part. And I tried for about 20 years from the time I left the White House until the Southern Baptist Convention took this policy in the year 2000 to bring the two disparate and some increasingly antagonistic groups of Baptists together at the Carter Center. And I had two meetings at the Carter Center with the leaders of the Southern Baptist Convention. And as a matter of fact, seven other participants turned out to be presidents of the Southern Baptist Convention itself, the top person in the Southern Baptist Convention. So I have a very happy life now as a more moderate Baptist. And the church where I was baptized is right down the street. Plains is a very tiny town. And the Baptists in the Plains Baptist Church and the Baptists in my Maranatha Baptist Church are very harmonious.
But wasn't it painful for you to break away? I mean, did the guys sort of turn against you and say, you know, you've let the side down?
I don't think it hurt the Southern Baptist Convention much when I withdrew. You know, I issued a press release, and as a matter of fact, to be technically accurate, individual human beings are not members of the Southern Baptist Convention. A church congregation is a member of the Southern Baptist Convention. And if you make a financial contribution to the Southern Baptist Convention, you are considered part of it still. So we never have made any division between our church and the Southern Baptist Convention. We give part of our offering to the missionary program of the Southern Baptist Convention. We give the other half of our offering to the more moderate group of Baptists.
When you talk to these men, whether it's Catholics who don't allow women to be priests, say you talk to the Pope, where you talk to a grand mufti or a rabbi or the head of the Southern Baptist, how do they explain their insistence on keeping women down? I mean, would you consider this Christian?
Yes.
In the largest sense of the word, is it Christian for them to do what they're doing?
I disagree with them, but you know, in my own little tiny church where we have about 35 active members and we have hundreds of visitors come every Sunday to hear me teach, you know, the curiosity of a politician teaching the Holy Scriptures attracts a lot of people. But even in our own little congregation, we have differences of opinion. You know, should we put on a new roof or should we wait another year? You know, or who should do this or that in the church? We have some differences. So I learned as a Christian, and Jesus learned in dealing with his own disciples, that you have differences of opinion and you don't turn against somebody just because they have a different belief from you. But I have a good relationship with some of the Islamic leaders. In fact, I would say the preeminent leader of the Sunni Muslims has worked very closely with me on this very book, the Grand Imam of Al-Azhar. He's the president of a university in Cairo that has 120,000 students, and he's also the spiritual leader of the Sunni Muslims, who comprise, I think, about 3/4 of all the Muslims on earth. And he has just had participated in a conference in Alexandria at their great library there on the same subject because we helped to organize it. And Karen Ryan, to whom I dedicated the book, was there and attended on our behalf. And when we had a meeting last June on this same subject, religion and women, women's abuse, he sent a delegation there with us. So I worked very closely with the leader of the Islamic faith to try to correct some of these problems. And as I said, I communicated with the Pope as well. And I've been very, last week, as a matter of fact, just because it's a pertinent news story, the Pope appointed, I believe, a committee of 8 people to try to decrease the abuse of children by priests. And I think 4 of those members of his new committee were women, which I think was extraordinary. And one of the women appointed by him had been abused as a child by a priest, I think in a convent. And so I'm not saying that the Pope did that because I said it, but the fact is that you can have different beliefs, you know, as devout Christians or Muslims or whatever your faith might be, Buddhist and so forth, and still worship the same God in the same degree of fervor and I think the same degree of sincerity. People honestly believe that a certain verse in the Bible prohibits women from being priests. That's fine with me. I disagree, and I can express my disbelief or my difference, but
Well, you can cherry pick the Bible, you know.
Well, anybody can, as I mentioned earlier, I think, on this program. There's 36,000 verses in the Bible, and you can go back and find one that would prove that God favors the killing of every woman and child in a village, you know, in order for the Jews to dominate in the Holy Land. But, you know, I don't believe that's not the image of God that I derive from the life of Christ.
Hear great speeches and interviews at Access Sacramento every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Propaganda, propaganda. If you want to fool the folks, it comes in handy. If you want to tell some lies, pull the wool over their eyes. You can do it with propaganda, propaganda, propaganda. You can liberate the babies from their candy. It's so easy, it's a sin, you're gonna want to jump right in. You can always depend on propaganda. Life is so hard, so confusing, Everyone's just trying to make ends meet. You can brighten up their day, keep the facts out of their way. Just simplify the complex, repeat, repeat, repeat. Propaganda, propaganda. If you need to change a subject, it's a dandy. If you want to wag the dog, it's like falling off a log. It's so easy with propaganda. Propaganda, propaganda. Try and convince the folks the beach is never sandy. You can convert into lies what they see with their own eyes. It's amazing, propaganda. Life is so complex, so confusing. Everyone's just trying to make ends meet. You can brighten up their day, keep the facts out of their way. Just simplify the complex, repeat, repeat, repeat. Propaganda, propaganda. Goes down easy like a snifter of old brandy. Gotta learn how to tinker with that hook, line, and sinker for easy to swallow propaganda. If you want to stir the pot, make it look like you're not. Just add a shot of propaganda. If you want to rule the roost and you need a little boost, I recommend propaganda. Propaganda.
And now back to Jimmy Carter talking about human rights abuses against women around the world.
Mr. President, I want to ask you one more question from up here on stage, and then we're going to go to the audience.
Okay.
So I'd ask all of you to be thinking of your questions, and we'll have a microphone. We'll ask you to line up, please. The microphone is over there. Mr. President, I want to ask you finally about the presidency. You ran for a second term and were not successful, and I know that must be a frustration for you as you look back.
I can see you're a good historian.
Yes, indeed. The incumbent president, President Obama, ran for a second term and was successful in getting reelected, but you'd have to say, looking at the last year, this has been a tough year for him. He's just getting pounded 24/7, it sometimes seems. This latest period with Russia seizing the Crimea is an example. I want to ask you, reflecting on what it is to be president, what thoughts you have about how President Obama could be successful in his remaining less than 3 years now. I'm sure you've thought a lot about what you would have done in a second term. You thought, here's a man who has that second term, but it isn't going very well. I think we'd all be fascinated to know what advice you'd offer President Obama in this time.
Well, yeah, I'm not qualified to give him advice on modern-day affairs. I've been out of office now for 35 years or so. But, you know, just take, for instance, the issue that you just addressed in Europe, I think just a couple of days ago. I think that the entry of Putin's forces into Crimea was preordained. I don't think anything that the Western world might have done, even the threat of military retaliation, would have deterred Putin from doing this, because the Russians, I know them very well, they always have considered Crimea to be part of their country, and I think a majority of the people in Crimea felt that they were part of Russia as well. So that was an inevitability. But I think that Putin has to be stopped now. And there you come to a parallel between what I faced and what President Obama faces now. On Christmas week of 1979, when I was president, Brezhnev ordered Soviet troops into Afghanistan. And I had to decide what to do about it. It was during the Cold War. And I did a number of very strong things, the strongest I could possibly think of. I withdrew my ambassador from Moscow. I declared an embargo against the Soviet Union. We began to arm secretly the freedom fighters in Afghanistan and give them weapons that they could use to deter the or deflect the invasion. We used all Russian-made weapons that we got from Egypt and Saudi Arabia and so forth in that respect. And I issued a statement that was called by some the Carter Doctrine, that to Brezhnev directly, if you go any further than you have gone already, we will respond militarily, and we will not exclude any weapons at our disposal. And that was about as strong a warning as I could possibly give. And I meant what I said. And I think Brezhnev knew that I meant what I said. They never went any further. And eventually, as you know, Gorbachev withdrew them from Afghanistan in somewhat of defeat or disappointment or disgrace. So I think we have to be strong in taking a stand, make sure we are taking a stand on justifiable and enforceable grounds. And I believe that President Obama has just as much fortitude and wisdom, maybe more so, than I had when I was president.
So just to ask the obvious question, should President Obama be saying to President Putin in Russia, if you move further, we understand your argument about Crimea, but if you move further across the border of Ukraine, an independent nation, into Moldova and Transnistria, the United States and its allies reserve the right to respond in whatever way they choose with use of military force as obviously a possibility.
I think the warning of our using our own military forces would be maybe excessive. I'm not trying to tell President Obama what to say. I hope I can say this three or four times. I'm not trying to give him advice. But I think that it certainly would be legitimate and maybe advisable for President Obama and NATO forces as well, as many countries as possible, to say we are going to make sure that the Ukrainian military are fortified and we'll give them whatever weapons they need to defend their own country. My guess is, knowing about Putin and knowing about Russians since I was there earlier, I think that Putin is not going to do this. I watched with great attention last week when he gave his speech, and he says specifically, we're not going to take military action in eastern Ukraine, as you well know. I think what Putin is going to do is to seduce the eastern Ukrainians who are in a Russian-dominated area to look with favor on Russia and try to convince them that they're better off dealing with Russia than the Western European countries, with favorable grants and loans and trade agreements and easy movement back and forth to international borders. I think he's going to do everything he can to convince them by persuasion and by demonstration, you're better off with me. And that's legitimate. So we can have a competition, I hope completely peacefully, between Western Europe and Western countries and Soviets about what part of Ukraine goes which way.
So I want to invite the audience to make their way. We already have a line behind the microphone. And so let me ask the first person in line. Let me just say, we have relatively short time, so I want you to keep your questions brief. Make sure they're questions. And if people start making speeches with apologies, I am going to cut you off because we just don't have enough time. So please identify yourself. Go ahead.
No problem. Thank you, President Carter, for being here, and thank you for your model of authentic leadership and putting your influence and your power into making the world a better place in many areas. So thank you very much, and to Rosalind.
Thank you.
My question is literally power. Renewable energy is empowering women in various parts of the country, in various parts of the world and the country. For example, there are women in Bangladesh and India exactly, and in rural areas in particular, where women are developing solar technologies and completely reversing a patriarchal society and taking economic development to another level. How has the Carter Center elevated that, participated in that, empowered that, and facilitated a greater use of that dynamic, because it can really change the socioeconomic structure and lead to women's empowerment in a nonviolent and economically sound way?
Good question. Thank you.
We're growing here, we'll blossom here no more. The hearts and minds of bureaucrats are rotten to the core. There's no investigation and no builder's hesitation as the playing fields make way for yet another shopping mall. The trees that once were growing here are learning of their fate. The bricks and slabs are piling up to build a new estate. The trees end up as household wood, we're told it's for the public good. And not to worry, saving earth is something that can wait. So let me tell you something, if I may, for what it's worth. We all have one address, and that address is planet Earth. Species are divisions, are the mountains, trees and seas. So why do we spend time and effort making more than these? When it comes to caring for the rock on which we live, All we've done is take and take, but no one wants to give. Temperatures are rising now, and so are all the seas. And gas and coal and oil use and emissions from all these. If nuclear's an option, then what lesson does it take to make us learn and not repeat Chernobyl's big mistake? So let me tell you something, if I may, for what it's worth. We all have one address, and that address is planet Earth. The animals keep vanishing as we proliferate. Then we spend time destroying other humans that we hate. If aliens are watching us, they'll give this place a miss and keep it from their children, hoping ignorance is bliss. As forests turn to open fields and fields then turn to sand, how will we tell our children that they just don't understand? The world that we are giving them's becoming a disgrace, a testament of failure to the stupid human race. So let me tell you something, if I may, for what it's worth. We all have one address, and that address is planet Earth.
And now for something completely different.